to be a good leader, you have to be a good listener, because you have to learn and you have to know how to adapt. And I think great leaders are able to adapt. They're not always able to have their say. They have to be able to be a good team leader and work with others. And that was something that I learned to do. You don't have to know everything. You just have to surround yourself with those that know everything. It wasn't an easy one when you've got 20,000 fans booing at you. And I'm going, wow, this is tough. This is interesting. So you have to adapt, right? So that's part of the leadership skills, is saying, okay, how do I pivot? How do I adapt in this moment and try to diffuse the situation? Well, leading with a purpose for me is making sure that we're not just talking the talk, that we're walking the talk. You have to be intentional in order to be impactful. And I think that's what a great leader is all about.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Another edition of the Tennis Worthy podcast brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McEnroe, proud to be the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame and proud to work alongside my following guest, Katrina Adams, who has pretty much done it all in the world of tennis, starting out as a top player, then becoming the president of the USTA for not one, but two terms, and helping us out here over the years at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. She also runs a great program here in New York City, where we both reside, or at least close by, at the Harlem Junior Tennis League. Welcome, Katrina. You are the perfect person to have on, as the theme of this month at the International Tennis Hall of Fame is leadership. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go back now to your years starting out, because you've pretty much done it all, right? From playing at a high level as a junior, growing up in the Chicago area, going on to college for a couple of years, big factor in the WTA, not only as a player, but as a leader as well, and then translating that into your many years with the USTA. So tell us how leadership have shaped your path throughout your entire career.
Yeah, my mom always said that I just had this aura about myself of getting others to, I don't want to say follow me, but I always had this confidence about myself to get others to kind of do what I wanted them to do. More so because I believed in myself and I believed in the journey that I was on, or the path that I was on, if you will. And, you know, I think it's about how you motivate others and the influence that you can have on others. So from an early age, I had that. And I think even in my tennis career and in the goals that I set for myself as a player, and getting my coaches to believe in that, and also following my coaches in the confidence that they had in myself. So as I navigated that course through college at Northwestern University, and being, you know, as a freshman playing number one, that shows leadership and getting my team to believe in me as a freshman and my abilities, and being able to motivate them and having that influence over them, and going on into my professional career on the WTA, and being able, you know, having someone like Zena Garrison, who is top 10 in the world, reach out to ask me to play doubles with her. You know, we went on to be number three team in the world, qualified for what was then the Virginia Slim Championships, which is the WTA Finals now. You know, that showed my ability to be a leader on the court. And that just kind of matured throughout my life and transformed throughout every stage.
To also be number one as a freshman, yes, you have to be a leader, but you also have to be a damn good player, which you obviously were. Yeah. So how did, when did you realize, because obviously I grew up playing junior tennis here in the Eastern section, and, you know, similarly went to college, and I didn't play number one at Stanford. By the way, I played number six when I started at Stanford. So that tells you about where my level was. But we had a pretty good team, as you did, I know, at Northwestern. When did you realize as a kid that you had the possibility of doing much more than you were obviously already doing on the court?
You know, I think as a kid, it's just something that kind of moved along with me. I never looked back. I always believed that I was that person, that I always wanted to be at the top of everything. I wanted to be at the top of my class, particularly in elementary school. You know, I think I finished third in my class by 1/100th of a point behind number two. And as it was coming down to the wire at the end, you know, we were competing to be valedictorian. And we knew we all were that close. And so, yeah, I was disappointed to not be the valedictorian or salutatorian. But I just had that competitive edge behind me. Now, I didn't take that academic prowess with me to my high school because my high school was very competitive. Or did I take it to Northwestern? For sure. But it was just something about always wanting to be in the front or at the top. And I took that to the tennis court with me and beyond. So going on tour, as you know, I joined the WTA Players Association board, you know, right off the bat, because I wanted to be involved. I wanted to know how the tour functioned, how we as a players association had a say. And that got me involved on the political side, if you will, that then got my juices flowing to carry me forward to where I navigated throughout my journey.
How would you say, Katrina, that because obviously starting out as a player in college and then, as you said, as in the WTA board, you know, I think that, I mean, I did a little bit of that as well. And you sort of come in having to listen quite a bit. But over time, you know, you obviously became such a big leader. How would you say your leadership style changed over time?
Well, to be a good leader, you have to be a good listener because you have to learn and you have to know how to adapt. And I think great leaders are able to adapt. They're not always able to have their say. They have to be able to be a good team leader and work with others. And that was something that I learned to do. I think being a great doubles player, you learn to work with others. You learn to work with your coach. And that helps you adapt to become a great leader. You don't have to know everything. You just have to surround yourself with those that know everything. And understanding that allows you to be a great leader. And that's what I was able to do as I, you know, went from organization to organization. And, you know, even being with the Harlan Junior Tennis and Education Program, you know, as we have evolved and grown over the years, it's surrounding myself with people who have the knowledge in other areas to allow us to grow. So it's just understanding how to adapt, how to be a great leader, and how to delegate well.
So you became the first African-American president of the USTA, the youngest person, if I'm not mistaken, to become the president. I believe you were also the first former player, right, to become the president.
Correct.
So that's pretty darn impressive on a lot of fronts. Talk to me a little bit about how you got started, though, before you became president. You served on the board for a number of years. So what was that like initially, and then the transition into then, you know, running and becoming the president?
Yeah, so I joined the board in 2005 as an elite athlete. We're a national governing body of the sport here in the U.S., and you have to have 20% of elite athletes on any NGB. And so I actually joined the board. Alan Schwartz was the president at that time and thought that I would be a good candidate to apply for it, and actually for the nominating committee. And I ended up being appointed to the board. Had no interest or really, I don't want to say interest, but understanding of what that entailed. And once I was on the board, I really got to understand who the USTA was. As you know, growing up, you played USTA tournaments. You had a USTA ranking. You knew about Davis Cup or then Fed Cup and the US Open. But you didn't really understand what the USTA did outside of that. Once I joined the board and really understood all the great things they did and how they gave back to the communities and to the sections and ran grassroots, and I actually realized that, geez, I was like a poster child of USTA. I played in our CDTA tournaments and programs, USTA Excellence Program, CDTA Chicago District Tennis Association. So that was my local district. I played in what is now the Midwest section. When I grew up, it was the Westerns. So all of these little teams that I actually participated in and USTA was funding, you know, without the USTA supporting these grassroots organizations, and, you know, I may not be where I am today or had the opportunity to progress. So I really became more interested and involved in wanting to make a difference and give back. And so having the opportunity to continue to evolve on the board year over year, when my expiration of elite athlete came up maybe 4 years later, you could, and then you only had 10 years beyond your retirement from the tour, I had to go in as a director at large. And I was like, there's no way they're going to reappoint me. I've got to go in with all these other business people and so forth. And I got reappointed as a director at large. So I said, wow, they really respect my point of view. And then I dove in even more so and got more involved, was on the budget committee, learned more about the organization. And then I really wanted to give more to the USTA, to tennis, and eventually decided that I wanted to go all the way. And I was fortunate enough to become the president.
So when you became the president, as I said, there was a few firsts in there, right? So you had to deal with that responsibility. I would say pressure probably as well, you know, that I see sometimes some of the emails that you receive. So I understand sort of the things, and I'm sure you had a lot more of that at the USTA as your president. So how were you able to deal with that and navigate that?
Well, you know what? I've got thick skin, Patrick.
well, we need that. Yes.
Thick skin. And, you know, I will say, unless you're in my shoes as a person of color, in particular, you don't really understand what you go through and what you receive. So I had a lot of naysayers that that came my way, as particularly as a first African American or first person of color, really, for the organization to be in that role. And, you know, I was surrounded by a great team, a great board, a great staff. Who believed in me, who protected me, who supported me. And so, you know, you put your head down, you go forward with your vision, with your priorities, and you get the job done. And that's exactly what I did. And so I did it well. I was able to do it twice for, you know, unforeseen circumstances. But because they believed in me and I was doing a great job, I was able to do it again. And so you just have to, you know, dodge the bullets as they come at you, literally, and go for it. And that's what I did. I was successful. I'm grateful for the opportunity. I opened the door for many others. So as you say, I was the first athlete. We've had two others since then, back to back with Patrick Galbraith as right. the next athlete. Currently, Brian Vahely is sitting there. I was the youngest. He has now surpassed me by a month, I think, as the next youngest going in. So, you know, it's been a fun journey.
It sounds like, though, being the first Black person was the most challenging, because there's been other women that were presidents and a few before you, Jane Brown Grimes, Judy Leverin, Lucy Garvin as well. So just how was that to deal with? I mean, I know you answered it a little bit already, but, you know, because in a sport like tennis, I mean, we both know that there's not that many Black people over the history of the sport. We know about the greats that have had left their mark, like Althea and Arthur and Venus and Serena and so on. You go down the list. But, you know, just the whole journey, you talk about the journey growing up in Chicago. You know, I'm sure most of the players you were playing against were white, going to play in national tournaments, so on and so forth, and then becoming the president. So just sort of navigating that whole journey, and then with it culminating with not just one, but two terms as the USTA president.
Actually, it was more rewarding than not, because now I was able to tap into not just my culture, but other cultures of color that were proud of me and supported me. So you know, I got all of the positives that came with that, and people that felt like they could reach out and tell their story that were never told before, the positives and the negatives, because they had someone that actually could relate to them and would respond to them and try to support them. And so it was definitely rewarding for me because I became their voice, a voice that they never had before. And I became their ears, ears that never listened to them before. And so for me, I felt that, you know, it was the best thing that ever happened to the organization. Hopefully it opened up a swell of opportunity for them to see us as an organization that could be bigger and better than ever before and understand how our sport could really deliver sport or deliver tennis in a way that it never had previously.
If I remember correctly, wasn't one of your messages, your themes while you were president was for the Hispanic community?
It was. It was one of my main ones because, you know, as you know, with our African-American community, our NJTL programs had really tapped into growing that community. And you can see where we are with a lot of our champions on the court today, and it continues to grow. We had our four pillars for our DE&I department at the time were African-Americans, Hispanics, LGBTQ+, and Asian-Americans. And so that was the four pillars. And so I focus on the Hispanic Latinx community because it was the fastest growing demographic in the country. And I wanted to make sure that we were tapping into that to help grow our numbers. You know, our theme today is 35 by 35. And so it was an opportunity for us to make sure that we were including a lot of families into our sport or bringing them into our sport that may not have tapped into tennis before. And we were quite successful in year one and two in particular in going out and being inclusive and engaging them.
One of the things you like to talk about, I've heard you use this phrase a lot, and I want to dig into it a little bit, is leading with a purpose. So what does that mean to you sort of philosophically, but also in real terms about getting stuff done?
Well, leading with a purpose for me is making sure that we're not just talking the talk, that we're walking the talk. And that's being proactive. That's going out and engaging people. You know, I always say that we have to send the right messenger with a message. And that means that you're leading with a purpose and that you're showing people that you care. And so in order for us to be successful with anything, you have to lead with a purpose. You have to be intentional in order to be impactful. And I think that's what a great leader is all about, because there's a lot of hot air that gets blown around with no purpose and no one, and with lack of intent. And it's just, you know, for show. And so that's what it's all about.
You wrote a book that came out a couple of years ago called Own the Arena. And in that you talked about a lot of the things we're discussing today and also some of the controversies. It's sort of inevitable when you're the face of the USTA that these controversies come up. So talk about navigating those as they came up in real time, and particularly when it happens on the biggest stage in tennis in Flushing Meadows at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, so Own the Arena, making a difference, getting ahead and succeeding as the only one, really focused, turned out to be more of a memoir unintentionally, but it's really more of a leadership book and understanding how to own your arena. And it has 12 chapters, so it has 12 winning match points, focusing on how to own your voice, owning your identity, and really owning your purpose, you know, and owning your successes and losses, and ultimately your possibilities. And so, you know, as you mentioned, you know, many things happen during a U.S. Open, before your eyes and behind the scenes. And so, you know, I opened the book really talking about the women's final 2018 against with Serena Williams against Naomi Osaka, Naomi winning her first U.S. Open, and with the blow up on the court with Serena. And, you know, one of the incidents in particular, which I didn't see because I was walking down preparing for the trophy presentation. You know, oftentimes when it's a set and a break, we tend to walk down, at least the women in particular, because depending on what shoes we're wearing.
Right.
Whereas the men might wait to the end because they can get down there a lot quicker. So with that incident and the blow up, I didn't see it. So I got down there, was a set and a break, and all of a sudden, you know, I hear the roar from the stands, and it's 5-3 now, and I don't know what happened. And, you know, I hear what transpired later from you guys on television, from ESPN. And so I'm confused and trying to catch up. Long story short, you know, I get out there from the trophy presentation, and now from, you know, we typically have a standard message that we're delivering to finalists and to the world. And, you know, I turn into Auntie Kat at that point because, you know, I know these two ladies very well. I know Serena very well. I've gotten to know Naomi at this stage early in her career. And, you know, delivering, trying to soften the moment for them because it's a raucous one and an overwhelming one for everyone out there. And, you know, trying to use my broadcasting skills.
Right.
Fortunately, it was me, I think, in front of a mic versus any other president before me or afterwards at that point. And, you know, it wasn't an easy one when you've got 20,000 fans booing at you. And I'm going, wow, this is tough. It's interesting. So you have to adapt, right? So that's part of the leadership skills and saying, okay, how do I pivot? How do I adapt in this moment and try to diffuse the situation and be soft about it, deliver this message, and then try to turn it back over to Tom at that point. So
yeah, it was tricky. I was actually sitting courtside, not working. I brought my daughters to the match because they wanted to see Serena. And I remember one of them said to me, and this was my twin daughters who were quite young at the time. My oldest daughter's a little more of a tennis player. So my twin daughters they don't really know that much about tennis, but like midway through the first set, they turned to me and they said, "Dad, I think Serena's going to lose." And I'm like, "I don't know. You think so?" But anyway, the point of me telling you this is I was sitting there literally in that little ESPN spot where the courtside person, because I was lucky just to get those couple seats, and I couldn't hear anything. So when the whole thing went down, and this is one of the things that, you know, our friends at the USTA have tried to address over the years, it was just impossible to hear actually what the umpire was saying. And I think that was part of the confusion over what happened, was that the acoustics in the building were so difficult that it made it very tricky. But you handled it with as our old buddy Arthur Ashe said, days of grace. You handled it with a lot of grace and as you said, a very tricky situation, because you want to celebrate Naomi, right, winning her first major, and also, you know, obviously feel for Serena, as many of those fans in that stadium did at that moment.
Yeah, no, it was a tough situation. And, you know, I was able to reach out to Naomi, you know, afterwards and apologize to her for just the way that our fans reacted, you know, how whatever I said apparently came off. She was gracious about it. But, you know, it's just unfortunate. You know, you win your first major, your first U.S. Open, you're supposed to be the happiest moment of your life, and she's there in tears, and
yeah. We're
not tears of joy.
No, that was not pleasant to have to see that. All right, let me pivot quickly to your broadcasting career, because I think it was it this year or last year, I turned on the Masters, and there I see you in, what do they call it, the cabin, the famous cabin, talking as you do on your CBS show, sort of a roundtable women's discussion. So how has that been, you know, gone for you, and why is that important to who you are?
Yeah, so it's We Need to Talk. It's a show that I do. It's a monthly show on CBS Sports Network and CBS occasionally. It's our 11th year. And there are, you know, we probably have a group of 15, 16 women. that we kind of rotate throughout the year, depending on the timing of the year. I maybe do 7 or 8 shows throughout the year. And so I have done the last 3 masters. I'm not sure if I'm doing next year, but it's, you know, we
pretty cool, huh? Because I've never been there. What's that like?
Yeah, it's really cool. It's, you know, I've gone before. Fortunately, I'd had the chance to go before I had actually done the show. But, you know, I'm a golfer. So just to be able to get out there and be in that arena, you know, it's people like to compare the Masters to Wimbledon.
Right.
Like, walk on the grounds and you just feel this, you know, this all the ghosts coming up, right, with all the things. And it's very special, a very special place. But, you know, for me to be there and work alongside people like, you know, Dottie Peppers and Kelly Tillman and Amanda Baliones, the real golf analyst, is special. And last year was Tracy Wolfson, you know, a popular voice on CBS. It's been very special. And, you know, if I'm invited, great. But if not, it's definitely been a treat. And I know like they like to rotate around, you know, with the analysts, and it's been a real treat.
Well, they're very lucky to have you, because that was like when I saw you come up, I said, oh, I got to listen to this. And you, I can't remember exactly what you were discussing, but you nailed, because you guys, you talk about a whole range of topics. All right, before I let you go, and I appreciate all your time here, Katrina Adams joining me here on the Tennis Worthy podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Got to talk a little bit about Harlem Junior Tennis and Education, which I know is near and dear to your heart. I've been lucky enough to have been honored there, to have been the MC. I'll be back again this coming year, which I'm looking forward to. I'm always blown away by, yes, the money you raise, but more importantly than that, the community, you know, and the connection, and seeing the kids, especially that I remember seeing when they were, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and now they're heading off to college. So, first of all, congrats on all you've done. And to me, of all the things you've done, which are a plenty that we've discussed, that's, I think, just a huge part of your legacy. What does that mean to you? And what do you hope for in the future for your work there and the community there?
Well, thanks, Patrick. First of all, thank you for always supporting us. You know what it's like to support organizations like ours, you know, any of the organizations in the NJTL network, the National Junior Tennis and Learning Network that the USTA Foundation supports. You know, I've been involved, like, can you believe it? It'll be 20 years. December is like,
I can believe it. Yes.
year anniversary. I grew up in a program very similar to this in Chicago. And so I said, if not for a program like this, I would not exist in what I do, what I've been able to accomplish. So, you know, it's a labor of love for me. But to see these kids walk in to our doors on a daily basis with their smiles and their little rackets and backpacks, you know, as a 5, 6-year-old, and then grow up to graduate from high school and go into college, and then come back as alum, you know, proud with their college sweatshirts on, you know, year one, year two. And then sometimes they're coming back and ultimately being coaches, you know, and I've been there long enough now to see that. It's so rewarding. You know, we're giving these kids an opportunity to be champions in life.
Right.
And our kids have gone on from Ivy Leagues down to community college and everything in between. And so, as you know, tennis teaches the life skills to be successful in life. And, you know, they're being doctors, they're computer analysts, they're, you know, cybersecurity, lawyers, you know, Wall Street, whatever they want to be. They're able to do it. We've got one young lady who wants to be a graphic designer. She's an amazing graphic artist. And so whatever that is, we are providing them the opportunities with college readiness. We have mental health support. Everything that we can provide to put them out in the world, we are doing that. And so my job, ultimately, you know, when I started, I was on the court with them. And now I've just transitioned to admin and raising money. We've been in the Armory since 1972 when we were founded. And now we're hoping to expand and find a location to build our own facility to so that we can have more courts, more court time. You know, we're limited with our court time and court space and our classroom space. We don't own the facility. We don't manage the facility. So we're relegated to the space that we have, which has been dwindling down over, you know, the years that I've been there, and particularly in the last 10 years. And so it's time for us to grow. And that's hopefully the next phase for what we're doing. So really appreciative of your support. Our gala will be May 11, 2026. We've been fortunate enough to honor Hall of Famers over the years. And I'm looking to secure Hall of Famers for 2026 as well.
You had Chrissy Evert this past year, so that wasn't too shabby. And looking forward to it again. And as a fellow New Yorker, thank you, Katrina, for all you do. And maybe more importantly, as someone who's run in some of the same circles as you over the years in the tennis world, thank you for all you do for the sport of tennis, for USTA, for Tennis Hall of Fame, but most importantly for the kids and being such a great role model for them in the future. And you're helping create, I think, great people and great leaders in the future.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Katrina Adams, her book, Own the Arena. You can search that up and check it out. Well worth a read. And thank you, Katrina, for joining us here on the Tennis Worthy podcast brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame.